Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls Media Roundtable. Last night, Kamala Harris and Tim Walz sat down for their first major interview with CNN's Dana Bash. Several of the questions were based on Republican talking points, and we learned nothing new about actual policies. Mark Jacob, former editor at the Chicago Tribune, who is now a media critic, tweeted, "When you're interviewing a presidential candidate, you should ask questions that matter to the public, not questions that matter to the other side's campaign." Kamala Harris was asked whether she supports an arms embargo to Israel, and we will play her answer during this segment. The United States recently approved $20 billion in arms sales to Israel, including scores of fighter jets and advanced air-to-air missiles. According to HuffPost correspondent Akbar Shahid Ahmed, the Biden administration has tapped Mira Resnick, an official deeply involved in weapons transfers to Israel, for a new role shaping policy at the State Department on the conflict. Akbar Shahid Ahmed is senior diplomatic correspondent for HuffPost, based in Washington, D.C. He is writing a book about the Biden administration and Gaza. Hi, Akbar. Thank you so much for joining us again.
Thank you for having me, Rose.
Well, Akbar, you have followed this issue so closely, you're writing a book about it. You've written about the officials who resigned in protest of President Biden's policy. The U.S.-backed assault on the Gaza Strip has killed more than 40,000 Palestinians, including almost 17,000 children. That is almost 3% of all children in Gaza. When you look back at the 11 months, has the Biden administration made any changes in its Israel-Gaza policies?
I think it's absolutely stunning that we're here 11 months in, right? We're at day 325 of the war, even by its own standards, by Israel's own standards of bringing home hostages, ending Hamas. I mean, there's more than 100 hostages, including 8 Americans, still in Gaza, right? And Hamas has not been defeated. Israel, if anything, is planning a new offensive, and there's no kind of end to the fighting in sight. I think that's really a product of the fact that the Biden administration has not wanted to change from the decisions they made immediately in the aftermath of October 7th. And those decisions were specifically, Rose, to say, look, we want to be providing Israel with weaponry, intensive support, be really, really deeply involved in this, putting U.S. fingerprints on this campaign, regardless of its toll, because we feel that's the only way we can influence Israel. Now, I think for many officials within the administration, for critics of the administration here in Washington, they understood that logic maybe from the beginning, but at this point, with hundreds, if not thousands, of alleged war crimes, with the U.S. itself saying that American weaponry has probably been used by Israel to commit war crimes and incur huge civilian casualties, it's really striking to people that there hasn't been a change. And what I mean by a change is not necessarily some dramatic move away from Israel, right? This is a decades-old U.S. partner, such close person-to-person ties, there's moral ties, there's strategic reasons for the relationship. So what people are talking about is something like shutting off the tap, right? Shutting off the spigot of continued weapon supplies to Israel. And the Biden administration hasn't been willing to do that. So in two instances, I'd say in this 11-month period, they've come close to doing it. That was after the World Central Kitchen attack. People might remember when healthcare workers were killed, including foreign nationals. And that was with a shipment of 2,000-pound bombs. These are hugely devastating bombs that just even military experts say are not appropriate in Gaza. The Biden administration came really close to saying, maybe now we'll change our policy of huge weapon support. But outside of stopping a small shipment of bombs, they haven't changed that, right? And we've seen the results, and we haven't seen the Israelis change our operations or the war come any closer to ending.
You brought up the World Kitchen. There's so many moving parts here. I just want to mention, this is from the UN press release. The World Food Program announced on Wednesday a pause in the movement of its employees in Gaza until further notice following an attack on a team returning from an aid delivery on Tuesday. So there's that. And then the Washington Post had another piece about the the Israeli strike aid convoy organized by a U.S. humanitarian group killed five. This was an arena convoy. Going back to these weapons, Akbar, you mentioned the 2,000-pound bombs. It's hard to wrap your head around just what we're talking about here. In June, Reuters reported that the Biden administration sent large numbers of munitions, including 10,000 2,000-pound bombs. You have to wonder how that's even humanly possible. But can you give us a sense of, you know, at this point, do you have any idea how many bombs the United States has sent to Israel? And would this all have been able to happen without support from the United States?
Right. So something important for people to remember, I think, is that the U.S. sends Israel upwards of $3.6 billion in military aid. And then separate from that, there's also $3.6 billion in military aid each year, I should say. And then there's also the U.S. weaponry that the Israelis buy with their own money. So this is a huge quantity, right? You mentioned the $20 billion sale that the Biden administration approved. Some of that is with the Israelis' own money. And also there's been additional U.S. funding for the Israelis since October 7th. All of that to say, Rose, these are such staggering numbers that it's really, really hard, even for American diplomats and people at the Pentagon, to actually keep an eye on it, right? Military aid to Israel is what's called untraceable, in that it's such a huge quantity and Israel is given such leeway with how it uses it that U.S. officials don't have a lot of visibility. What we do know and what is indisputable and what Biden administration officials are well aware of as they are having these conversations about continued shipments is the consequences of these weapons going there, right? And that's something that humanitarian organizations have talked about in terms of their workers being targeted, in terms of healthcare facilities being targeted. And I just think it's really important for people to understand is that there's a domino effect, right? So, for instance, we're now seeing polio spreading in the Gaza Strip, a disease that had been wiped out there 25 years ago. That's a direct consequence of the fact that since October 7th, including an attack using American weapons, the Israelis have targeted critical infrastructure, water infrastructure, sanitation infrastructure. So there are all these cascading effects that are leading to mass deaths. And I think at this point, the administration is saying it's hard to get off the train they're on. But arguably for healthcare workers, for Palestinian families who are there, it's never too late, right? Of course, more than 40,000 people are dead. You could stop another 40,000 being killed, potentially. And this question of how do the actual U.S. weapons get there, there's constant shipments. There's daily shipments, right, that are happening, getting over to Israel. And there are people at the State Department, the White House, and the Pentagon who are tracking those shipments, facilitating them, despite the fact that in these investigations of war crimes and in ongoing cases at the International Criminal Court and the International Court of Justice, U.S. officials could potentially in the future be held responsible for war crimes, for being part of these shipments. So there's a real kind of long-term question of accountability here.
Where would that come from? Who would start that process?
So there's a few ways. I mean, there's the international judicial system, right? If the ICC, which is currently considering arrest warrants for both leaders and Hamas, the Palestinian militant group, and Israel's prime minister and defense minister, if they were to say, you know, we've decided that X number of American officials who were involved in weapons shipments facilitated war crimes, they could put out arrest warrants. And then the onus goes on to other countries, right? Will those American officials feel comfortable traveling to countries that want to uphold that ICC arrest warrant? There's also been attempts at cases within the U.S. that have been less successful just because we have to see this all in the context of post-9/11 and the huge leeway that presidential administrations, both Republican and Democratic, have taken over national security and have been given by judges and by Congress. So the other kind of branches of government that are supposed to be doing oversight and accountability just haven't been doing it for decades in multiple wars. It's hard to see them doing it in Gaza. And then finally, I think, you started the segment talking about Kamala Harris and Gaza, and I think that could be a political tool, right, in terms of accountability for the Democratic Party for facilitating this war, despite all its promises of standing up for universal human rights and various other values.
Well, to that point, CBS and YouGov are out with a poll showing that 61% of Americans oppose sending weapons to Israel to continue this assault. That includes 77% of Democrats, 75% of Black Americans, and 66% women. You reported just yesterday that Senator Bernie Sanders is going to introduce a joint resolution of disapproval to block $20 billion in weapons sales to Israel. You write this is very significant. It means that the Senate will have to vote on Biden's biggest post-October 7th weapons sale. The nuance is, will Sanders disapprove of different parts of the deal in different votes, as many Democrats would like? And then how will Chuck Schumer respond? What else can you tell us about this?
Absolutely. So Senator Sanders hasn't yet introduced this resolution, but once he does, it actually does have what's called privilege. So that means that he can force the Senate to do an up or down vote on this. It's not a vote that the Democratic Party would like to see happen, because it is something that is going to splinter the party and show that there are many senators who are in control of this policy. I mean, months ago in January, Sanders forced already a vote on the Gaza war, a vote that was just to require a human rights report. And you saw something like a quarter of Democrats in the Senate voted with him. I think at this point, when the toll has gone even greater and the kind of strategic rationale for the war has dissipated even further, you'd see a higher number of Democrats do that. That's not the signal that the party wants to be sending, you know, just a few months out from Election Day. But it is a reflection of the fact that the Biden administration is so removed from where many Democratic primary-based voters are, and also where many Americans are, just overall. I think what we'll see is that vote will likely happen later in September, potentially in October. Congress is out a lot over the next couple of months. But Senator Sanders seems really determined. I do think, to the point that I made in the tweet, I mean, there are ways that you could break up parts of this vote and say, look, we want to vote on specifically these missiles, which we know are killing civilians. Let's vote those down. Let's at least disapprove of those. And again, that's a political signal, right? It doesn't necessarily have teeth immediately, but it's something that could make the Biden administration think, maybe we should hold off on this shipment for now. Because as I said earlier, it's never too late until the bombs, the missiles, the munitions actually get there, right? So while they are approved right now, they haven't yet been transferred. So there are things legislators and activists could do if they really want to stop them. And so could President Biden, ultimately.
Akbar Shahid Ahmed is senior diplomatic correspondent for HuffPost. He is writing a book about the Biden administration and Gaza. Kamala Harris and Tim Walz sat down for their first major interview last night with CNN's Dana Bash. Here is Kamala Harris answering a question about an arms embargo.
We have to get a deal done. This war must end. In the meantime, and we must get a deal that is about getting the hostages out. I've met with the families of the American hostages. Let's get the hostages out. Let's get the ceasefire done.
But no change in policy in terms of arms and so forth.
No, we have to get a deal done. Dana, we have to get a deal done. When you look at the significance of this to the families, to the people who are living in that region, a deal is not only the right thing to do to end this war, but will unlock so much of what must happen next. I remain committed, since I've been on October 8, to what we must do to work toward a two-state solution, where Israel is secure, and in equal measure, the Palestinians have security and self-determination and dignity.
Akbar, what did you make of how Kamala Harris responded to that question about an arms embargo?
I'd actually begin with the end of the question, end of her answer, Rose, because she said she made this point that the Biden administration has been making since they took office, right? This idea that they believe in equal measures of dignity, security, self-determination for Israelis and Palestinians. And it's just incredible that 3 years later, with this war, with more than 40,000 Palestinians dead, and of course more than 1,200 Israelis dead on October 7th, they haven't delivered that equal degree. And it looks to a lot of officials inside the administration and observers outside that they don't believe in that. So for her to be giving this similar rhetoric, I don't think it'll land. I mean, there has to be something more. In terms of an arms embargo, that is a demand a lot of activists are now making, some unions have made, who are major players in democratic politics, of course. It's very hard for me to see a scenario in which Vice President Harris endorses an arms embargo. I think that's extremely unlikely. That said, many Democrats, including Nancy Pelosi, including many senators, have said, we don't believe in an overall arms embargo. We believe Israel should have the right to self-defense, but let's not send them offensive weaponry. And I do think there's a middle ground there that she could inch towards if she wanted to. Vice President Harris is a cautious politician. I don't think she wants to say anything she'll be pinned down on or held to. But I do think there'll be increasing pressure for her to be more specific. Okay, if you're not going to an arms embargo, which she said repeatedly she is not going to do, are there particular types of weapons, 2,000-pound bombs, particular air-to-ground missiles that you just won't give to the Israelis? And I think that expectation is very much there, but she's trying to keep the focus on saying the word ceasefire, since that was kind of an early call from activists. That's insufficient in this moment, right? I think ceasefire negotiations have been in overdrive since May, and they haven't delivered.
What are you hearing, Akbar, given that you have so many contacts within the State Department? What are you hearing about how Harris will be or will not be different from Biden on this issue?
Yeah, the hope among people kind of in foreign policy circles is that at the very least, her process and the advisors around her are quite different from President Biden's national security team. President Biden has relied in particular on this one extremely controversial Middle East official named Brett McGurk, who's kind of seen by a lot of folks in the foreign policy establishment as sidelining expertise, very much rooted in Bush administration thinking about the Middle East, because that's where McGurk got his start. And there is a hope that Harris's team, under a couple of advisors, specifically Phil Gordon, Ilan Goldenberg, these kind of more moderate voices, might at least be willing to engage with diplomats and other foreign policy professionals who disagree with this policy more. And that has been their experience to a degree already, right? To the extent the vice president has played a role in the Gaza policy since October 7th, my understanding from officials on the inside is that team has been kind of less derisive towards criticism of the policy and maybe interested in some shift. I don't think there'll be a dramatic shift. I also know from her team, from people close to her, and you see this in her answer in the CNN interview, she's really, really worried about being seen as anti-Israel, which seems remarkable to think about, given how much support the administration has given to Israel. But this is a longstanding democratic fear of being seen as weak on national security. And then there is a concern about alienating hardline pro-Israel voters. I don't know how much change we can expect, and I don't know how much on the campaign trail she'll indicate that, but I would expect in a Harris administration, foreign policy fundamentally will be made in a different and more flexible way.
Akbar, you have a new piece out called, it's an exclusive, Joe Biden appoints hawkish official to lead Israel policy at State Department. Former State Department official Anel Shaleen says Biden's pick would, quote, provide unconditional material support for Israel's genocidal campaign against civilians in Gaza, end quote. Tell us, who is Mira Resnick? She's an official deeply involved in weapons transfers to Israel.
Absolutely. So she is now the new kind of top Israel-Palestine official in the State Department's Middle East Bureau. And the significance of this, Rose, is that they chose someone out of the Weapons Sales Bureau, right? And I think that in itself is so telling about where the administration still is. It's still looking at the Israeli-Palestinian conflict through the lens of weapons supplies, security assistance for Israel, and kind of even a long-term commitment. I mean, there is talk about potential U.S. troops being sent to Gaza as a kind of future plan to stabilize the region, which I think would be extremely controversial. Resnick is
an
official
who is talking about sending troops, U.S. troops to Gaza?
Yeah, senior former officials are having these conversations. They've actually put out some public reports describing this plan. The idea being after the war, right? Not to engage in fighting right now, but the idea being if fighting ceases, having the U.S. send troops as part of some kind of stabilizing peacekeeping force. I think that would be hugely controversial. But there are advocates for it here in Washington. I think you could even see some advocates for it within the Biden administration and potentially a Harris administration. I think it's a really dangerous and scary prospect, given that even once all-out fighting stops, the likelihood of a really severe insurgency in a really destabilized, dangerous region is very high. But there's a feeling that Arab countries and other countries with the U.S. wants to see got involved wouldn't go unless there's U.S. skin in the game. Resnick as an official is interesting. She's deeply experienced. She's well-respected, but her role since October 7th has really been trying to find ways of stability and transparency for weapons shipments, right? So the Biden administration in many ways has tried to keep weapons shipments under the radar so that Congress can't question them, so that journalists can't know about them. And Resnick has been really involved in that. So I think that's where a lot of the concern comes from.
So why is he doubling down by appointing her?
I think from the administration's point of view, there's several levels who feel we do not want to show any daylight between ourselves and Israel because Hamas, Iran, other kind of forces that the U.S. and Israel both see as oppositional would take advantage of that. All of that said, if you look at the bigger picture, the U.S. has clearly overwhelmingly given Israel support since October 7th and has even supported policies that the U.S. has said are unhelpful, right? Like the continued blockade on most aid getting in, the fact that Israel hasn't turned back on the electricity. There are so many steps the U.S. could have pressured Israel on that hasn't. But there are folks in the administration who still feel we need to continue sending a signal that we're not abandoning Israel. And I think that is, to a degree, there's a sort of backed into a corner feeling among some administration officials. I mean, at this point, they know how controversial the policy is. They know that by so many of its own metrics, it hasn't succeeded. And so they're defensive, right? And I think that they're maybe acting to a degree out of that defensiveness rather than how do we get to a safer, more humane policy.
Akbar, we've asked you so many times when you've been on this question, how long can this last?
Yeah, it's horrifying, Rose. I mean, there's no other way to put it. I mean, you have close to 2 million people crammed into around 14% of Gaza, which was already a really small strip of land to begin with. I think on the Israeli side, at this point, there's not flexibility in the ceasefire negotiations. And that's kind of the thing. I mean, that's the barrier. I used to think there was no way we would get to, you know, U.S. election day in early November with President Biden still letting this campaign go on the way it has. Now my expectation is I don't know that we'll see a ceasefire or even a truce by then. Mm-hmm. The indications are not encouraging either from the talks or even from, we talked about polio earlier. There was a hope that even just for polio, which is such a huge risk, they might agree to a week-long ceasefire. And even that wasn't achieved. But there's a real determination on all sides to keep going.
So this is The Guardian reports that the WHO is delivering 1.2 million polio vaccine doses to Gaza as pauses in fighting agreed. So there's going to be a 3-day pause?
Well, 3-day, during 3 days for a specific set of hours, there will be a pause, is what we're told. All of that said, Rose, I mean, it's important to remember the Israelis have not released their operating procedures in Gaza, and we have seen them in many instances target healthcare workers. So while they may say there will be a pause, there is still a risk and a really serious fear that soldiers who are kind of shooting at anything that moves to an extent will do that, even in this period.
And the baby, the first baby to have polio, is partially paralyzed. It's so devastating to think about the bombs stopping for a couple of hours here and there, and then they resume. I want to end by talking about someone who recently lost his life, because we keep throwing these 40,000 numbers around, but these are people with lives. NBC reports that hundreds of online tributes have been left for a content creator known for sharing videos on social media about his life in Gaza during the assault. 19-year-old Meadow Halimi was killed after he was hit by shrapnel during an Israeli airstrike on the southern city of Khan Yunis on Monday, several of his friends told NBC News. His Instagram page is filled with videos about what it's like to live in a tent, the garden he was trying to grow, and going to the beach to escape. Meadow and his family had been sheltering in al-Mawasi after being displaced 5 times following an Israeli strike on his home. Here is Meadow Halimi 2 days before he was killed.
We come to a point to feel, just to accept that we're not safe anymore. There is not any moment that we would feel safe. We're just gonna, we always have this feeling that at any moment, we might be the next ones to die. So I don't know. People don't even have space to live in anywhere with a tent. So they would set up a tent right on the beach. Like if some high waves just, you know, come by, it's gonna just soak their tents. Mm-hmm. In my last video, I mentioned that we set up a new tent from our home in the same area that we only had enough area for 2 tents. So right now we don't even have enough area to walk. And that's actually the situation for most Gazans in this area, yeah. In this area right now. You mentioned we are resilient, so we try to find light in the darkest moments here. As you've seen on my videos, the sight on the beach, the view on the beach, is where I daily go. That's basically my escape from reality. Like no matter how depressed I feel in the day, no matter how low I feel, I just go to the beach during sunset. I watch that view. It is really amazing. I literally forget everything I'm going through. And the same thing with my family. I want all people to understand that no matter what the situation we're going through, no matter what happens to us, no matter what they do to us, we're always going to fight. We're always going to stay resilient no matter what. We are strong people. No one can beat us. So no matter what happens, we're still going to get our homes back. We're still going to go back. And for sure, one day, everything we're going through is going to end. Mm.
19-year-old Meadow Halimi was killed after he was hit by shrapnel during an Israeli airstrike on Gaza's southern city of Khan Yunis on Monday, several of his friends told NBC. Akbar, this is another tragic story. It's also just so tragic, though, that we don't see the stories of Meadow in the media, even though he's on Instagram day after day, just talking about his life, talking about what we heard there. We just hardly see young people like Meadow.
I think there's an effort by media to kind of, by some in media, to address what is a really old pattern, right, of not focusing on Palestinian pain and even Palestinian lived experience, whether it's joy, whether it's ambitions, whether it's dreams, whether it's just family moments. That is a problem. I think people are talking about it more than they have in the past. At the same time, Rose, I can't even begin to describe the amount of attacks, abuse, and scrutiny that journalists writing on this war face. And I think there's a real fear around elevating Palestinian stories and voices sometimes because there is such intense pushback from supporters of Israel who say, well, you're forgetting the October 7th attack. And I think I do think as journalists and as just observers of this conflict, we have to be really clear that we are able to keep in mind both the hostage families, those affected by October 7th, and those who are suffering right now and today. But it's a very hard thing. It's a very difficult needle to tread. And you've seen this even from the political establishment. You know, a week ago today, I was leaving Chicago after the Democratic National Convention, where they did have, because parents of a hostage in Gaza, they did not have a Palestinian American speaking from that stage. And that was an absence that was really felt. But I think that comes from a kind of skewed understanding of who should be platformed, who should be focused on in this conflict that's changing, but not quickly enough.
Mm-hmm. Akbar Shahid Ahmed is senior diplomatic correspondent for HuffPost, who is writing a book about the Biden administration and Gaza. Thank you so much for your reporting, Akbar.
Thank you, Rose. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us. Coming up after a break, we will talk about a Mother Jones investigation about the future of AI and surveillance technologies along the U.S. border and their potential human rights and privacy consequences. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.